Welcome to the Healing Ground Movement, a podcast dedicated to revolutionizing how we think about our bodies and our health. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, DC, and I have lived my life in pursuit of holistic healing and care that goes beyond symptom management. If you've been listening and like what you're hearing, head over to your favorite platform and leave us a review so we can reach more people with our important message. Enjoy today's episode.
Hey everyone, today's episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. ButcherBox partners with people who are dedicated to doing the right thing, never cutting corners and always looking for ways to improve. Discover why they're the trusted source of high quality protein for families across the country. At ButcherBox, they believe in better. For them, that means caring about their animals and the planet, treating our planet with respect. It means improving the lives of animals and the livelihoods of farmers, and ultimately, it means better meals enjoyed together. The protein from ButcherBox is never given antibiotics or added hormones. It's humanely raised. Our family loves the convenience and quality, and knowing that we are getting humanely raised and sustainably harvested protein. You can customize your box with the right amount of food and variety of meat to fit your family's individual needs. If you're interested in getting a special offer, go ahead and head to healinggroundmovement.com/resources to follow the link for ButcherBox. Hi friends, it is giveaway time again. Today's guest, Katie Cryer, has generously gifted us with a copy of her book, Yoga for Addiction, Using Yoga and the 12 Steps to Find Peace in Recovery. We have a signed copy for our listeners, and all you have to do to enter is head over to Instagram at Healing Ground Movement and find our giveaway post. All you have to do is tag someone in the comments, like the post, or share to your Instagram stories. All of these options will enter you into the drawing to win your very own signed copy of Yoga for Addiction from today's guest, Katie Cryer. I hope you did enjoy today's interview and head on over to Instagram to get your copy. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. I am Dr. Carly Hudson, and with us today, we have Katie Cryer. We're going to take another look at yoga and movement and the health and wellness of our body. But today we are going to spin it a little bit differently and have a deep dive discussion about addiction in all of its many forms. Katie is the founder and director of Square One Yoga, a small independent chain of yoga studios in the San Francisco Bay Area. She is also the author of Yoga for Addiction, Using Yoga and the 12 Steps to Find Peace in the Present Moment. Katie's founding mission for Square One Yoga is the same mission for her writing, to present and teach yoga in a way that is accessible and unintimidating for everybody. I think we're going to talk a lot about yoga beyond the asanas. Wow, I'm already struggling with words today. It's going to be a good conversation. But yoga beyond the asanas and really getting into the in-depth meaning. So Katie, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I have really enjoyed your book. We have Yoga for Addiction, and you do such a beautiful job drawing through the themes of, you know, some of the AA 12-step program, but also a lot of the deep meaning of yoga with the yamas and niyamas, and marry them so beautifully together, because really they teach a lot of the same things. But I'm curious, how did you get started on finding this pairing and its meaning for you?
Well, my experience is that I had done yoga, like, you know, sort of as fitness for mm-hmm. some time, but not seriously, not consistently. And then parallel to that, I was trying to get sober and going to AA, and, you know, I was in it for a while, but I didn't stick. You know, I had a big relapse and I was just struggling for a long time getting back into it. And I started going to yoga class at a Buddhist center. And it corresponds exactly, the timing is exactly when finally sobriety stuck for me. And it took some time for me to realize that the reason why that happened is because I was in yoga class, finally learning and having the skills to be in my body in a way that wasn't so unbelievably painful that I had to reach for something else. And yoga gave me that. And they don't teach that in AA, unfortunately. I have never experienced anyone saying those exact things or giving practices for that.
And I think that's something that is missing
across the board. And we've had, it's going to be no mystery to our listeners who have been hearing a lot of episodes about this lately, about where we need to marry that place of emotions and psychology into what is happening in our body. But it's an element that is a little bit new to recovery, whatever, you know, kind of work that you're doing, to say that we have to be able to inhabit our body as a safe space is kind of a new construct.
Unbelievably, yes, yeah. Right.
I guess I have to say it tongue in cheek.
There's not separation here between the head and the body. Imagine.
I know. I was like, and now I have to catch myself. I was like, I don't think it's actually new. I think we just forgot it for a long time.
Yeah.
And then, so a little bit of a caveat, I think, is that, you know, we're going to talk a lot about AA, and, you know, neither one of us are an AA sponsor. We are not here, you know, promoting that, nor are we here to throw it under the bus. And I think this is a big part of your book, is that it's seeking recovery in whatever way works for you. And I know that's a big tenet of AA as well, is it only works if it works for you. And so just a little, you know, disclaimer in case we raise everyone's heckles, because this is a really personal journey that people go through.
Can I say something about AA too?
Yes.
AA worked for me, especially initially. There's a lot of kind of, this is my opinion, a lot of black and white thinking and instructions, and do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. And I think it also, AA can be sort of re-traumatizing for women, because it has such a bit, and it's been so slow to change in terms of like even pronouns, or let's stop talking about this just in terms of men, or those of you who are familiar with the literature, like the chapter to the wives, where the women are only wives and they're only codependent. And I think that a lot of, you know, when they still haven't caught up with women. Well, what about, you know, transgender people? So I feel like in many ways, AA is very behind the time, very, very behind the times. And I can see how that could be really difficult for some people. So I would like to say that just to, as a preface, because it's not for everyone, which is too bad.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that's a great premise. I didn't know that about AA and its origins. You know, we in my family were a big fan of the Big Red Book, The Adult Children of Alcoholics and Addicts. And, you know, some of that language does have the dated pronouns and the dated experience of gendering experiences in one way or another. And I always hate when it sneaks up on me when, you know, based on my upbringing in the 80s and 90s, it's like, oh yeah, that's normal. It's not normal anymore. We're working to change all these things. So thank you for calling that out. So let's kind of dive into a little bit of what we're talking about now. We have this ability to discuss navigating the world of recovery for people that don't fit into AA, that maybe there's a lot of tenets that start there, you know, recognizing that we're powerless, taking stock and inventory of ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of really great lessons here. So how do we start to navigate the world of recovery without throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. You know, what worked for me was just to really understand AA and the context in which it was created. It was created in a different time and with a different, you know, a different culture. The culture was different in the 30s and 40s when AA was founded. So I had to understand that and kind of give it a break. I think more and more I'm giving it less of a break because they've had time. And there's also good reasons why Alcoholics Anonymous is slow to change, because they found something that worked for a lot of people. And so there's a very long and involved process to change anything about the literature for good reason. So I think understanding context first and foremost is important. And then, you know, a lot of people change the pronouns. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a beautiful act of defiance, that when, you know, when you're reading out loud in a meeting, change the pronouns. If it says God, say goddess. You know, when you're reading the literature, I've seen people do this. I never did this, but crossing out all the he's and putting she's. So I think that there are strategies that can make it work for anybody, and to sort of take what works and get the help that you need and understand the context and leave what doesn't work behind. That's one thing. The second thing I'll say is that there are other programs that also work for people. So lately, I've been going to Recovery Dharma, which is a beautiful, inclusive program of recovery that has, I think, the best parts of AA and none of this other, you know, gender is very inclusive. So, you know, just seeking out women's meetings, Recovery Dharma, other programs that work and where you can find that sense of community and the inquiry and the sort of cleaning up mm-hmm. and taking care of some of the trauma that we've created.
Absolutely. And I love that point about navigating AA and then having opportunities outside of this structure is, you know, that's one of their tenets is take what works and leaves the rest. And so that's an open invitation to be a little bit rebellious and a little bit defiant. So what shows up in your book that I think is really phenomenal though, is that you do take a lot of those 12 steps and then you pair them and discuss them more thoroughly with these yogic principles. And of course, you know, for our listeners or anybody who has been involved in yoga for a long time beyond the world of athleticism and cardio, we know that yoga is not just the asana, not just the physical practice, but also the internal change in awareness. And those are the yamas and niyamas, and then we have an Eightfold Path. Can you talk a little bit about how you started pairing some of these really productive steps that come into the world of recovery and how you found that connection to the yamas and niyamas, and give us a little crash course there.
Yes, there's so much there. And I think as sort of a baseline of how to discuss this, I think that I'm not that familiar with many spiritual traditions, but I can say for Buddhism, for yoga, and somewhat for Christianity, that there are some underlying principles about living a spiritual life and that they're common across the board. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Griffith wrote a wonderful book, One Breath at a Time, about, you know, sort of like my book, it's been years since I read it, but it takes Buddhism and the 12 steps and marries them. And so I think we could take anything, but specifically to your question about the yamas and the niyamas and the Eightfold Path is that few things, like the one that's really coming to mind is the concept in yoga of surrendering to God, Ishvara Pranidhana. Well, now that I'm recording it, I won't be able to say all the words. And the idea, like the serenity prayer in yoga, serenity prayer in recovery, which probably everyone knows. Should I say it?
Yeah, go for it. I didn't actually realize the serenity prayer wasn't just like a spiritual prayer in my house until I was much older. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, this comes out of AA. We just say this all the time.
Right. It's so deep. I mean, we just say it, but it's really quite deep. So it goes, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So to me, what that's saying is that, I mean, whether you're an addict or not, doesn't matter, that most of us are constantly fighting reality, you know, constantly up against things that are not under our control, like COVID, you know, oh my God, we all just experienced this massive trauma of which we had very, very little control over. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I think most humans, including myself, just fought it emotionally, intellectually, in the way that I behaved. And it's just not a useful way to expend energy. Mm-hmm. And so surrendering to what is a beautiful concept, both in recovery and in yoga. We have it both places. And it's a way to find peace. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the other piece is that there are things we can't change. So we're not just collapsing. Mm-hmm. We're looking at our lives, which is another thing that's common both to recovery in terms of the fourth, fifth steps, even 6, 7, 10, 9,
all of them,
eight, all of them, you know, looking at ourselves and our behavior, mm-hmm. and how it's been, for lack of a better word, maybe maladaptive. It hasn't helped us in life. And in yoga, we have the same concept mm-hmm. of self-inquiry. So there's lots of ways, but those are the two big ones. And through self-inquiry, I'll say, is how I figure out and manage the things that I do have control over.
Mm-hmm. I think those are really, that's a really deep and rich place to start. And so what we're talking about in some of these principles, yogic principles, is it's the niyamas, the spiritual observances. And I'm just going to say right out there, I got nothing on Sanskrit. It's not a language I have practiced. I can barely pronounce most of my English words. So I beg everyone's grace. And Katie, please jump in with
pronunciation. Me too. I wrote a book about it and I still can't say the words.
So we mean to do this with our very best intention, without appropriating, but mostly to take the wisdom that comes from these teachings. But these spiritual observances have a lot to do with things like self-discipline and self-study. And okay, as you were talking about, this is how we observe and a little bit come to grips with the things that we cannot change, the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. To say, you know, I can not change the viral spread of COVID. I do not have a butterfly net big enough in the world, and heck, the viruses will go right through those little holes anyway. So it's there. I cannot change that. And that self-study is, do I have a desire to change that? Do I have a desire to control what's outside of my world? And then we have the discipline to let that alone and come to what we can control. And as we look at that in the terms of addiction, you know, it becomes very personal and very emotionally charged, but so did everyone's experience with the pandemic over the last year and kind of as the residue continues this year. It demands a bit of surrender. All of these are examples of the niyamas. These are observances that are not just present in the yogic tradition, but also, as you were saying, we see them kind of across the board in a lot of faiths, is the golden thread that is about ownership of ourself and surrender to what's outside of ourself.
Yeah. And you said a word that I sort of picked up on that mm-hmm. I'd like to pick out. Discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an interesting word because I'm a person in many ways without a lot of discipline. And I think that's true of a lot of people who have this, you know, these addictive tendencies. For lack of, mm-hmm. I don't like those words. I'm getting into words these days, like let's find the right words for this stuff. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
discipline's very difficult for me. And even with my yoga practice, which I fundamentally believe is one of the most important things that I do for myself, can be difficult to do. And it's not until I integrate these things as a part of my being that I'm able to do them without the discipline, that they come as a natural course because they're part and integrated into who I am. And I think that recovery is like that too. And you know, if you have a substance or a behavior, if a person does, if I do, and, you know, so society, therapists, our own selves telling, stop doing that, stop doing that, stop doing that. And we're using some kind of discipline to keep ourselves away from a substance or a behavior is very ineffective and doesn't work in the long term. So mm-hmm. I think that one of the wonderful things about finding a practice is that it's something that can be integrated into how you're being and how you are and relate to the world so that you don't have to do these things as a matter of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like meditation. Okay, so it's so difficult to sit down and meditate. So, so hard. And that's another thing we're just pushing against many of us, you know, in this world of healing and wellness and spirituality. Have a very difficult time doing that. So why don't we find ways to practice that work for our constitution and for the way that our brains are structured instead of fighting against it? So finding a yoga, even asana practice, is so broad. You know, I say yoga, people have no idea what I'm doing. Maybe I'm doing like 50 chaturangas in 1 hour. I might just be like lifting my arms overhead. That's what I do now. It's very mm-hmm. simple. Let's just lift our arms overhead. It means so many different things. And so there's so many ways that we can connect to it. And that will require less and less discipline or no discipline at all, because they're a fit for who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, that word, I don't know. Is this making sense?
Okay. Yeah. And I love writer to writer. I love getting into the nuance of words and meaning and origin, because we do have to be careful about the words we speak and how we intend them to be used. A lot of words come from an origin that has been so adulterated over the years of use that it is so far away. And discipline is one of those words that it's, its root is coming from instruction and knowledge. And so the original use of instruction and not of discipline is instruction or knowledge. So if we were to take the niyama, the tapas of the niyama tapas, which means self-discipline, it is self-knowledge or self-instruction, which becomes that internalized thing, Katie, that I think you were talking about, which is instead of white knuckling our way through something with an exterior control, with I have my checklist, or the really, I think, popular way to talk about it these days is I am going to find a hack for this so mm-hmm. that I don't have to effort my way through, but it remains external to me.
Right.
Versus, and I love the language you use, integrated as part of my being. Instead, we find the self-knowledge and the self-direction to say, this is part of what makes me feel whole and healthy and happy and makes me feel safe in my body, such that I am not turning towards a substance or behavior, because addiction, I mean, has become such a huge umbrella, as it rightly should, to cover almost anything that keeps us from self-witnessing and self-presence. So if I have that self-discipline, if I have that self-knowledge and the behaviors that keep me whole and safe in my body, rather than externalizing an ought to, which, you know, becomes that kind of white knuckled sobriety. It works until it doesn't, because you haven't changed your relationship with self. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I'd like to pick another word. Mm-hmm. Tapas. Let's talk mm-hmm. about tapas. What is tapas? Tapas is heat. It's fire. It's actually internal. It is internal. And many of us who've gotten into things like we are apt to do if we're have that personality. When I get into AA, the first 5 years of my life in recovery with AA were full of tapas. I was into it. I read all the books. I met with my sponsor. I went to all the meetings. That's tapas. That it looks like discipline from the outside. Like maybe that's willpower, but it wasn't. It was an internal drive to get this thing, you know, to get it.
Yeah.
Yoga, I get into yoga immediately. I'm like going to class every opportunity. I'm signing up for retreats. I'm signing up for teacher training. That's tapas. And again, looks like discipline because I'm going to yoga every day, but actually is an internal fire mm-hmm. because I'm seeing something that I cannot articulate, but that I know is the direction I went ahead.
That self-knowledge and that self-understanding of direction.
Yes.
And I love this direction in that integrated aspect. And as we look at some of the other niyamas, maybe you can pick one and continue this kind of guide of that internal heat or that way of being. Because I think as people are looking for their own way out or in or through, pick your direction, we see that externalized part. Version with the Instagrammable photos, the checklist manifesto of, say, someone like you who is doing yoga every single day, or they're getting their 30 meetings in 30 days, or it is this external discipline and it appears external and it appears as though you are, knuckling your way through. And sometimes it has to start that way until the fire takes over. But can we take it that next level deeper of what that healing really starts to look like when we let that fire go inside, when we open up to that internal change that doesn't look like external control?
are you asking if we are in a state or we spend time in a state of having this internal fire that's top us? Mm-hmm. What is the result of that? What does that look like? Is that the question?
Yeah, as opposed to perhaps this this external observation.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah. So I want to be inspired by you. And I think you are just going through a checklist, but instead you're lit up from inside.
Yes. If you're lit up from inside, it's sustainable. Mm-hmm. Period. If you are lit up inside, this is something that you can maintain for over time. So not that what we're doing doesn't change. My relationship with recovery is vastly different today than it was 15 years ago when I got sober. Ditto yoga. Mm-hmm. Not that it doesn't change, but that we're finding a way to make it work in our life so that we keep wanting to do it every day. And that's what I keep telling my yoga students. You know, I'm teaching asana. Do you enjoy what you're doing? You know, do that chaturanga. Fine. If you enjoy it, if it's not pleasurable, it's not sustainable. We have to find pleasure in life in these things. So I think that tapas, perhaps, I'm just speaking sort of off the cuff here, is a way of discovery. It's a way to fire up and look and find and see what works for us. Mm-hmm. When we find what works, we're able to sustain it. Mm-hmm. If we're just doing things off a checklist, like forget that, that will last. I mean, trust me, like all the times I've tried to sit and meditate, now I do it. I do it just for 8 minutes. I have a little guided meditation. I do it every morning. It's no problem. But so long, I'm like, meditate for 30 minutes. Just do it for 30 days and see what happens. And the weekend, I'm like, that's all right. I'm kind of busy. Let's not do that. And so what works? What do we find pleasure in? You know, that's where the heart is. And I think that that's what we can find once we get that internal fire going. Feed the fire. If you like yoga, keep going to yoga. Feed it, feed it, feed it.
Yeah. And to me, that speaks a little bit to, and I'm going to try not to butcher this one, to another niyama, santosha, which as we get to the root of that is simplicity. And I think that we have a habit to plaster our walls with quotes and directions and accessorize and make something big to validate its presence in our life. And what I'm hearing you say about finding what's sustainable, finding what works, finding what's pleasurable, is that all of these extras can really distract us from what is really, what we're really learning about ourselves and our own path towards recovery in whatever way we are pursuing it.
Yeah. And another way to think of santosha is contentment. How do we cultivate contentment in our lives? And so that can happen on the mat with what I'm talking about, with doing the things that feel pleasurable. And the big, here's another parallel with recovery is gratitude. Is, you know, it's not, how do they say, what's important is not having, what's important is not having what I want, it's wanting what I have, which really rings true for me. And so having, it's sometimes I've had like explicit gratitude practices. You know, I've had sponsors tell me, write a gratitude list. And so like a good little recovering person, I wrote my gratitude list and it was enormously helpful. And then over time, same thing that we're talking about, it becomes more integrated. So I can take a walk. It's like, wow, it's so cool. I live in this place. There's all these trees. You know, it becomes more of a natural daily practice. Mm-hmm. If I'm in good shape, trust me, it's not like always I'm like, oh, beautiful trees, look at the butterfly. No, but when I can, then I'm cultivating santosha.
And again, it's taking that external behavior and internalizing it, integrating it. I keep going back to this quote from you, integrate as part of your being. Because if we have the whole point, and I think this is a little piece that gets missed in so many wellness and healthcare practices, whatever it is that we are using them to recover from, whether it's addiction or chronic pain or something in body dysmorphia and eating disorders, which can be argued as part of addiction, all of these things is that we start off with really great practices and they're all really wonderful so long as we're doing them. But so long as we leave them in this external world without integrating and internalizing it, the gratitude practice remains a checklist and not something that you have integrated into, I now have an and again, we can make memes for all of these, an attitude of gratitude, that now you are seeing the beauty as you look outside your door. And it doesn't have to be always. It's not to say that you can't have a negative thought now and again, but what good is it if it remains outside of us rather than really trying to internalize and personalize this practice?
So, yeah, there was something said in the beginning that I wanted to respond to, and I'm just a little bit drawing a blank, but yes, overall, yes. And we're going to have 10,000 negative, I have 10,000 negative thoughts a day, or I will say, maybe not negative, 10,000 unwanted thoughts a day. I'm pulling that number out of the air. And the practice is not having negative thoughts. That's not the practice. The practice is saying, oh, here I am. I'm ruminating. I'm thinking about that conversation again. I'm doing it again. Gosh, seems like I've been doing this all day. You know, the practice is not disavowing or shutting off those. The practice is realizing that and being like, oh, okay, I'm going to take a few deep breaths. I'm going to look at the tree. Mm-hmm. So that's my internal life.
Well, and yeah. That practice, you know, the practice is not to have perfection in whatever way, but what you were just describing to me here sounds a lot like the practice is surrender.
Back to surrender.
There back to surrender, which I know I'm not going to say that one. That's another tenet of a niyama. And you said it earlier, the Isvara. Oh, I'm not going to get there. Can you?
Yeah. Ishwar Pranidhana. I think I'm missing a syllable. I will say I'm dyslexic, so if I have it in front of me, I can say it just fine, but I don't. But yeah, there it is again. You know, and part of what we're surrendering to is our humanity. And as human beings, that's what we're doing, is we're, you know, Rick Hansen, I think, said our minds are Velcro for the negative, Teflon for the positive. Mm-hmm. So this is who we are, and the practice is to keep coming back to who we really are. And that's the beauty of yoga, is that essentially, boil it all down, what do we get? That we are not separate, that the truest part of ourselves is not separate from the universe, God, higher, whatever you want to call it. We're the same. We're whole and perfect. We already are. And that's so hard to remember, but I think, if there's nothing else that we get from yoga, let's take that. So at least we have a hint, a little seed mm-hmm. to remember.
That's beautiful. And so we've talked a lot about, you know, some of these spiritual practices of yoga and the niyamas. We didn't dive too much into the yamas, but which are more of the moral restraints. And that does remain a bit more external, but that's how we engage with our community. So actually, I guess before we dive into, because I know we're both super excited to talk about embodiment and healing, and it's just been a giant theme of our podcast this year, and I make no apologies, and in fact, you'll be getting more of them, is how does acting in community in yogic principles also support our recovery?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind when you say that is another thing about being human is that we're social animals. We're mammals, you know, we need people. We so need people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not sure that that's, I'm trying to think of a way that that is emphasized in yoga. I mean, certainly we have Sangha, our spiritual community. We, you know, a lot of yogis go and live in ashrams and communities, but what is coming to mind is another wonderful quote. I think it's another name, Johan Hari, someone like that, that the opposite of addiction is connection. I'm bungling the quote, but mm-hmm. essentially that, and this is true for me. Like when I think back to the first time that I got drunk, I've been thinking about this moment a lot lately for a lot of reasons, but my entire adolescence particularly was full of me feeling separate, different, weird. I was the one in middle school that like nobody wanted to talk to. And then I got drunk And that changed 100%. I was connected. I liked myself. I had friends. People wanted to talk to me. And that's the experience that I think I've heard over and over and over again in meetings. And so we found the medicine that works, right? And I think that that other stuff I was talking about is the result of trauma, which we'll get to, right? Mm-hmm. And then we find a medicine, right? And what we need then is a better medicine that doesn't ruin our lives, mm-hmm. right? And so we have to learn that and find that. And that's a process.
Absolutely. And I know, gosh, I can't remember who did this study. And I always want to say Stanford because they're always messing with mice, but that might not be fair to Stanford or their mice. But they ran a study on addiction in mice and found that they gave the mice an addictive substance and then they detoxed the mice off of it. And they put the mice either in community and they made like this beautiful mouse playground with nice rolling hills and little wheels for them to run on. I mean, it's just a beautiful little community for these mice. Or they left them alone in a sterile dank box. And the one, and I think this was actually pain medication, so it was opiates that they were coming off of. And then the mice that were in community of the rolling hills, even when offered the opiates again, did not partake, did not care, did not need. And of course, these opiates, they have a way of triggering some of these happy neurotransmitters. And so they didn't need them. But the mice that were in the sterile ookie box, well, they needed the happiness and they went back to that opiate and they relapsed and became addicted again. And so that became a landmark study in talking about what is addiction, what are we trying to do with it, and that search for community and that participation. And then I like what you're saying about finding the right medicine, finding the right thing, the right behavior to make it work. And so then when I think about yoga and yogic principles and community, you know, I think about the yamas, the moral restraints. And when we think about things like ahimsa, the nonviolence, or satya, truthfulness, asteya, non-stealing, these are all ways to participate in community, but it's not just about, I'm not going to steal from you, my neighbor, but I am also going to not steal from myself by maintaining healthy boundaries. And I will be truthful to you, my neighbor, but I will be also truthful to myself. And in this way, we become part of a cohesive environment rather than, as you were describing, you know, before you had your first drink, this separate and away, which also, as you acknowledge, often comes from trauma. Yeah. So I love those pieces of pulling together.
Yeah, you're right. and I'll say that, you know, through years of addictive behavior, through trauma, you know, sort of one of the things that happens in addiction, almost by definition, I think, not to say that addicts are selfish people. I hear that. No. Mm-hmm. What happens in addiction is that the thing that's most important to us is the substance or the behavior. And so that is a very selfish way of living and can, the result of that is sometimes for me, it was stealing, lying, being unavailable. And so you're absolutely right that now we have a framework both in yoga and in recovery of how to relate to people and be parts of community in a more, useful way, mm-hmm. not a better way, more useful, you know, what's going to lead to healthy and long-lasting relationships.
Yeah. What works and what doesn't. And again, I think selfish is one of those words that has become so used and twisted and you know, relabeled and gone through some terrible PR. But, you know, selfish is really just looking at being self-centered, putting yourself at the center of your life. Mm-hmm. And that is not a bad thing. That is the baseline of put on your oxygen mask before assisting others. Yeah. So it's, what are you doing at the center of your life in that selfishness? Are you putting on your oxygen mask so that you can assist others? Or are you putting on a band-aid of addiction, whether behavioral or substance, so that you can avoid some feelings or, you know, or come away from the trauma? Yeah. Both are hard, you know, pick your hard and which one is going to work better for you within your community.
Yeah, I'll tell a little personal anecdote about that. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school at some point, like I was going to treatments and all that stuff, I got this diagnosis, oppositional defiant disorder. And I haven't really thought about that much, but it occurred to me recently. I was like, that's not a disorder. That was actually self-care. I was taking care of myself because the people who were in charge and were telling me what to do were not safe people. Mm-hmm. So actually I was taking care of myself. So, you know, in their mind, I'm being self-centered. And what was actually happening is that I was going towards the things that worked, which was my community, you know, substances, et cetera. But that's where I was safe and I wasn't safe with them. Self-care, not mental illness, self-care.
Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the things that are working, that are keeping you safe, and I think this is a great segue into trauma and into this kind of embodiment idea, is that, you know, we have to be gentle and offer forgiveness to ourselves for our behaviors that no longer serve us, because at one point they did.
Yeah.
At one point, and this feels very odd to say and very odd to hear. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt, chew on it, you know, spit back out what doesn't work. That's the nature of this conversation. But at some point, this behavior was preferable and safer to what you had available.
Right.
That's right. And then not.
Right.
And that's where that gentleness has to come from, is to arrive at the, and now I need to do better. Now my life and my situation is better and I can do better. But it is part of that journey of recovery.
Yeah. And this is something I realized 30 years later, this idea that, oh, I was taking care of myself 30 years later. Mm-hmm. So decades of thinking like that I was defiant, you know, like, I mean, I didn't think about that much, but like 30 years later, I have compassion for that 15-year-old who was just doing what made sense. Mm-hmm. Right? So yeah, it takes time.
Yeah. There's so much research to say that it's not that humans misbehave for the sake of misbehaving and for the sake of being contrary and evil. It's to say that we make the best choice based on what we have learned and what we know. Mm-hmm. And at 15, when the people that are supposed to be taking care of you and guiding you are not doing that in a safe way, what a 15-year-old knows is not great. That's why we're not allowed out in the wild at that age typically. But yet you are doing the best that you knew at the time to take care of that 15-year-old you, because someone needed to. So on that lovely and uplifting note, talking about then, so we've talked a lot about the yogic principles, and I think our longtime listeners have heard a lot about the yoga. Yoga is just so much more beyond the postures, beyond the strength on the mat. And there's a lot of these principles that can guide us, but let's not miss the fact that embodiment, that physically moving and changing our body and connecting that mind spirit to our corporal being, is such an important part of recovery. Whether it is emotional, addictive, chronic pain, pick one, we are our bodies. So you said that your addiction finally stuck when you've really got into yoga.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not your addiction, your recovery. I misspoke.
My addiction to yoga really started.
Yeah. So tell a little bit about kind of that shift and that change.
Well, you know, what my book says is that what I said earlier in this podcast, which is that we learn to live in our bodies, you know, it's uncomfortable and we do it anyway. But I'm having a thought, which is a little bit like out there in the edges of my brain. Mm-hmm. But I think also, if we want to start talking about trauma, the other thing that I believe, I'm beginning to believe about these movement practices, is that so much of trauma is about not having agency over our bodies. And we learn to have agency over our bodies. And I think, you know, for me included, when I got into yoga, I got into really vigorous, you know, like I wanted to do headstands and handstands. I wanted to do vinyasas. And so maybe, I'm taking a guess here, that I was really strongly reclaiming agency over my body. If I can do a handstand, which is something I couldn't even do when I was a kid, then I have power in a way, I have agency and power in a way that I have never had. And so it makes sense to me that as we're going into yoga, we might choose these like big poses. And then over time, you know, aging has a way of
humbling us.
Not really what I'm interested in anymore, but it certainly works, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm beginning to think, not just embodiment, yes, also agency. Let's mm-hmm. take back our bodies.
And we hear a lot of stories about that. We had an interview with an ultra marathoner. Oh gosh, this was back in our first months of the podcast. But again, him becoming an ultra marathon runner was about a recovery from addiction as well. And it's doing these extreme things to have agency over our bodies and to come back to a physical being that, you know, perhaps in many ways we have left behind. And if there is discomfort to be felt, it's the discomfort of a headstand or, you know, the 100 mile of a Leadville race, which is not a discomfort I'm reaching for, but some people do. Or the pleasure of feeling your muscles stretch or the runner's high. And that becomes a safe inroads. And we've talked about this in other conversations. And I know you and I both love the Body Keeps the Score, Dr. Ben Vessel's book, that it is finding feelings within the body that are safe, that are not triggering. So in this way, you can return to your body and feel the discomfort that is muscle soreness and the stress of holding yourself upside down, not the anxiety of fear, am I safe?
Right.
It's finding a pathway in that isn't too overwhelming.
Yeah. And here's a segue that I don't think we were planning on, but not all yoga spaces are safe and not all recovery spaces are safe.
Mm-hmm.
We have enough stories, and I can say about recovery for myself that it was, in many ways, those aren't safe spaces. So again, it's like finding our way, finding the safe ones, finding the safe yoga spaces. Do you feel connected when you show up? Because yes, I keep talking about going to yoga. As you know, some people just practice at home alone, which is totally fine. I think those of us who seek connection, it's really helpful to find those spaces. So finding safe mm-hmm. ones. But that's a little bit of a branch. Not exactly where you were going, I don't think.
No, but I think it's a really important thing to point out, because I would not want our listeners to walk away thinking, great, I'm just going to go to whatever shop down the street, you know, whatever label they have, and think that it's going to be all the sunshine and roses and deep emotional work that we're looking at. You know, yoga as it came to the United States, and it's been around for quite some time now, kind of got its roots going in the early 1900s and then really boomed in the 70s and 80s. But a lot of the yoga practice has been appropriated into a cardio-centric fitness craze. And then some of the yoga classes will go back and work on bringing in the yamas and niyamas in the spiritual practice of yoga and rounding out the principles. But some of that is a backtrack that doesn't really start from the root of what makes yoga safe and transformative. Yeah. So unfortunately, while yoga and its practices can be an incredible tool for recovery, it can also be a mislaid trap for the uninformed.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. unless yoga practitioners are pretty much going to workshops, doing teacher training, doing their own reading,
mm-hmm.
you're just going to class. Most folks will never be exposed to yamas and niyamas. They'll never hear anyone say you're already whole and perfect. You know, mm-hmm. you have to kind of look for that. Yes, but appropriate it. So we're just going to fitness classes. Even the best yoga classes, the best asana classes, we may never hear those things.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe we should define asana as the poses, essentially, mm-hmm. for people who might not know. Yes. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So as we find those places that feel safe, and there are more and more yoga locations, I know at least here in Denver, and then of course you're in San Francisco, and you have your yoga studio that clearly this is part of your practice and part of your teaching. There are trauma-informed yoga practices. There are places that talk about the additional training and the different additional exposure that teachers have or their place of origin. I know Courageous Yoga is one here in Denver that has opened up that is really working on changing how yoga speaks within the community. When you find that place, what is available to you and what does embodiment do to that transformation? Now, with our caveats aside.
it connects. It connects the parts of ourselves that have been disconnected. And I say for me, I'm not even aware of what's happening. But here's what happened. When I went to that Buddhist center and I had my first taste of what I would say is a really integrated practice, every single time in Shavasana, I just cry and cry and cry. Like there's just tears, just so many tears. And I've seen this. This is not unique to me. This has happened to a lot of people. And what I'm realizing now, looking back on that, I didn't know why I was crying. Why am I crying? And it's because exactly that the trauma is stored in the body. I'm doing this embodied practice. And so it's coming up. It's coming up and it's being released. So although it's uncomfortable and a little bit embarrassing, I think that that's the best thing that could have happened is this integration of my separate, disassociated emotional life with my body. Mm-hmm. They belong, they are the same. They belong together.
They absolutely are. And I don't know if we've ever talked about it that directly before about expectations. And I think that some people do arrive, and I think we talk about it in massage and chiropractic and other somatic experiences, body experiences, that these things happen. And I like how the language you use just normalize the experience for coming to the mat, that it shows up for people. And it's not strange. It's not abnormal. Yes, it can be embarrassing. Like we can definitely couch this in the societal norms of the United States. We don't cry in public here as a typical rule. Maybe we should, but we don't. So it can be uncomfortable, but I think it is far more normal than we expect to have these releases. When we keep our eyes on our own mat or our back is to someone who might be crying behind us or might be quietly, you know, have tears quietly streaming down their face in Shavasana, the corpse pose at the end of practice where we lay down and inhabit our bodies through after this somewhat often strenuous or transformative experience. We don't know, and we think we are the only one, but the nature of somatic practice is this is how trauma and emotion moves through our body. And it happens to everyone, whether or not we have the language or the space to talk about it.
I love that. Yeah.
Because it's happened to me. I'll just, you know, the number of times on a massage table, a chiropractic table, yeah. A yoga mat, one time on some trapeze silks, or not some trapeze, on silks in doing circus.
Yeah.
The body moves and the trauma moves with it.
Yeah. So if any of your listeners are finding that that's happening to them, I would say, I think that you're in exactly the right spot. You're right.
Yeah. And if it's overwhelming and scary, there are lots of ways to find support for that as well, so that it can become something that starts to feel safe again.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Katie, thank you so much for bringing your experience and your wisdom to this conversation today. I love the vulnerability with which you shared what really is hard-won teaching. And there is a type of teaching that comes from study, and there is a type of teaching that comes from embodiment. And here's my favorite quote from you again, integrating this as part of your being. And that wisdom to me is always aspirational and always worth, worth a listen, and to see if there's a takeaway for any of our listeners here today.
Well, I love this conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
And can you tell our listeners, so you're based in San Francisco. So you tell our listeners where they can find you, where they can find your book, Yoga for Addiction, Using Yoga and the 12 Steps to Find Peace in Recovery. All the wonderful ways to get more information out of you.
Yeah. So I will say my studios are in the East Bay. They're in the Oakland and surrounding areas. And so if you're in the East Bay, you can come to classes now. Yay. And we're also online. All of my classes are online. And I do teach Yoga for Recovery on Sunday mornings at 9 Pacific. So I invite everyone to come. You can find that by either my website, which is Katie Cryer. I'm sure this is going to be in the show notes. Yes. So find it in the show notes or through the studio Square One Yoga. The book is available, everywhere. So your preferred vendor of these things, you can find it.
Shop small. Awesome. Yeah. Well, Katie, thank you so much. Excuse me. Thank you again for your time and your stories and your experience. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. I hope this conversation sparked a few new inquiries for you about behaviors around self-care, what you're trying to do. And I'm going to put the emphasis on the word try here. What are you trying to do externally? What is that newfangled definition of discipline that is dripping in control that maybe could become softer and turn into an embodiment of self-knowledge, self-awareness, selfishness, and centering yourself on your mat? It's a bit of a head turn, but I hope you'll take it for a spin. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time with another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Be well.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.